Luke 18:31 to 19:10, the 75th talk in a series entitled The Gospel of Luke, was presented by Jack Crabtree on September 21st, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to be in the Gospel of Luke. It's been a long time. Is it years now or months anyway? But been a long time since we've been looking at Luke. I'm not going to do much by way of review, but I'll just give you a brief idea of where we're at in the Gospel. But then we'll just jump right in where we left off. As I understand the structure of the Gospel, you have what is roughly a chronological account of Jesus' birth, beginning of his ministry, the course of his ministry largely in Galilee, but also in the Transjordan area, and roughly a chronological account right up to the time that he's in his last trip, on the threshold of his last trip up to Jerusalem. At which point the gospel breaks, and then you have a whole vast section, maybe not vast, but a fairly significant section of Jesus' teaching that is not located in any particular part chronologically or even geographically in Jesus' ministry, and you have several chapters of that. And then at the point that we're at today, I think he begins to pick up the chronological account. So that's where we are. Most recently, he's sent out his disciples to proclaim to the villages, not now it appears not in Galilee, but in the Transjordan, and they've gone out casting out demons and proclaiming the coming of the kingdom of God. And they come back together for the trip, the very last trip to Jerusalem. And that's the scene. So we're in chapter 18, and we'll start with verse 31. Then he took the 12 aside and said to them, "Look, we are going up to Jerusalem, and all things which have been written by the prophets with regard to the Son of Man will be brought to their intended end. Indeed, he will be handed over to the Gentiles, and he will be mocked, and he will be outrageously mistreated, and he will be spit upon. Then after scourging him, they will kill him, but on the third day he will rise again." Now they understood none of these things. His pronouncement was hidden from them. They did not understand what he was saying. Excuse me. It's very interesting how detailed Jesus' prediction of what's going to happen to him is. When I first realized this, it blew a hole in my conception of how this all went down. Because I think for the longest time, I just assumed that Jesus was really coy about what was in store for him. But we see here, and it's in Matthew as well, I believe, we see here how utterly detailed and explicit he is about what's going to happen in Jerusalem. He's not at all coy about it. It's just, I'm going there, they're going to mistreat me, they're going to scourge me, they're going to kill me, on the third day I'm going to rise again. In that regard, it's astonishing that, as Luke says here, they understood none of these things. His pronouncement was hidden from them. They did not understand what he was saying. Well, what is it about killing that's hard to understand? What is it about scourging that's hard to understand? I mean, why could they not understand any of these things? I think what Luke is getting at is the disciples here, and notice that it's the 12. It's not the larger group of disciples at this point. He called the 12 aside and gave this information to the 12. I think the reason is because a larger group of people could have organized themselves into a mob to try to prevent these things from happening. He's not interested in inciting them to protect him. So he takes the 12 aside and he makes this prediction. But notice how he puts it. "Look, we are going up to Jerusalem, and all things which have been written by the prophets with regard to the Son of Man will be brought to their intended end." Okay, well, that's where he gets misunderstood right away. Because what are they expecting? You know, what do they hear him saying when he said, all things which have been written by the prophets with regard to the Son of Man will be brought to their intended end? Well, what they're expecting is, okay, he's going to go into Jerusalem and he's going to drive the Romans out and he's going to defeat that Roman honky and he's going to be the king and he's going to rule. And that's their expectation. And then he goes on and says, indeed, he will be handed over to the Gentiles, he'll be mocked, and they don't get it. I mean, that's a complete disconnect for them. They don't understand that what Jesus means is the crucifixion and the raising from the dead, though that's his intended end. So they think at that point he's just kind of in a bit of a pout, pessimistic, overly concerned that this isn't going to work out, and maybe Jerusalem won't accept him. And they're probably just dismissing all that as ungrounded pessimism. So they're not even hearing that part. All they're hearing is, okay, everything that we have always expected from the Messiah, you're going to go into Jerusalem now and actualize that, realize that, and bring that to pass. So I think that's what Luke is getting at. They understood none of these things. His pronouncement was hidden from them. They did not understand what he was saying. It is significant if you get into any conversation with academics or Jews, one or the other, it will be commonplace for them to look at the prophecies of Jesus as not in any way predicting his crucifixion, his death for our sins, his suffering on our behalf. That wasn't the role of the Messiah. And they will shift their interpretation of the prophecies on to someone else or onto the people of Israel itself or something like that. But Jesus seems to be implying very strongly here that he reads the prophets as if the prophets were indeed predicting that his intended end would be to come to Jerusalem and die and then raise from the dead. So you go with the academics' interpretation or Jesus' interpretation. You know, take your pick. Okay, now he goes on to the next account, and the chronology begins here. Verse 35. It came about when he was near Jericho. A blind man was sitting by the road begging. Hearing the crowd passing by, he kept asking what it was that was happening. They told him that Jesus, the Nazarene, was passing by. So he called out, saying, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Those in the leading edge of the crowd kept telling him to be quiet, but he kept calling out all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me. Now Jesus stopped and asked for the blind man to be brought to him. When the blind man got near, he asked him, what do you want me to do for you? And he said, Lord, that I might see again. So Jesus said to him, see once again. Your faith has made you well. Directly the man could see again, and he began to follow Jesus, glorifying God. Now when all the people understood what happened, they offered praise to God. Okay, a number of things of interest here. This has nothing to do with interpreting the passage, but it's probably significant enough that I want to spend some time on it. There are some parallel accounts to this account. Let me read those accounts to you. This is the account in Matthew. As they were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him. The two blind men sitting by the road, hearing that Jesus was passing by, cried out, Lord, have mercy on me, Son of David. And in case you missed it, I'm emphasizing leaving Jericho here. The crowd sternly told them to be quiet, but they cried out all the more, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. And Jesus stopped and called them and said, what do you want me to do for you? They said to him, Lord, we want our eyes to be opened. Moved with compassion, Jesus touched their eyes, and immediately they regained their sight and followed him. That's Matthew's account. Now here's Mark's account of the same passage. Then they came to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a large crowd, a blind beggar named Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the road. When he heard that it was Jesus the Nazarene, he began to cry out and say, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Many were sternly telling him to be quiet, but he kept crying out all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus stopped and said, call him here. So they called the blind man, saying to him, "Take courage, stand up, he is calling for you." Throwing aside his cloak, he jumped up and came to Jesus. And answering him, Jesus said, "What do you want me to do for you?" And the blind man said to him, "Rabboni, I want to regain my sight." And Jesus said to him, "Go, your faith has made you well." Immediately he regained his sight and began following him on the road. Now, I read the entire accounts because I don't think there's any question but what they're the same historical event. And yet there's some significant differences. I didn't read the New American Standard version of Luke, but the New American Standard version of Luke reads something like, "As he was entering Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the road begging." So you have two significant facts that are different between the three accounts. Matthew and Mark tell us that this happened as they were leaving Jericho. Luke, according to the New American Standard, locates it as occurring when they were entering Jericho. That's one issue. And then the other issue, of course, is that Matthew says there were two blind beggars. Luke says there was one. Mark only records one, and his name is Bartimaeus. So there's the one blind beggar, Bartimaeus, who's the one that is whose eyes are healed in this event. Years ago, decades ago, when I was studying the issue of biblical inerrancy, this was one of the favorite passages that people would point to and say, "See, the Bible is not without error. Luke tells us that this occurred as Jesus was entering Jericho, and Matthew and Mark tell us that this occurred as he was leaving Jericho. They can't both be true. Something's wrong somewhere. There's clearly an error here somewhere." So I want to comment on that. As I was reading those things, one of the solutions that got offered to, well, no, let me back up. Let's take the issue of how many there are first. It is not uncommon, actually, in the New Testament accounts to get a difference between how many people we're talking about. And I think there's always, I think, the same explanation pertains. Notice that Mark names the one person. This is not just some anonymous blind beggar. It's Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. He's known to Mark and probably known to the Christian community in Jerusalem. There, Mark is telling his story. Because he's telling his story, the story focuses only on him. The fact that he had a sidekick, the fact that he had a friend who was with him, who is also healed, is not necessarily important for Mark's purposes in telling the story of Bartimaeus. That would especially be true, and there are times where we see this. If you remember the account of the legion, the man who's I would say infested. What are you with demons? You have a bunch of demons. The one account, gospel account, says there's two people there in the tombs that are being bugged by demons. Well, it becomes clear in that case that yes, there are two of them, but one of them is by far a dominant personality in that relationship. I mean, it's just the nature of human relationships that oftentimes friendships will involve a dominant personality and someone who is their good friend, but is not dominant in the relationship, is not socially dominant, is not the social face of the relationship. I expect that that's what we're dealing with here, is that there was Bartimaeus, who is the dominant figure in this friendship. He had a friend who is another blind beggar, and he led this other friend with him, both of them, appealing to Jesus, the son of David, to be healed. God healed both of them. But you can readily see how with that kind of relationship, in an outsider looking on it, would tell the story of Bartimaeus, who is the assertive one, the initiator, the leader, the one who is really the social face interacting with Jesus in the event. So I don't see that as a problem. I mean, that's just a matter of the author choosing what perspective to take on the telling of a story. No story has all the details. No gospel account gives us everything about everything that occurred. I mean, that's just a given. The author has always been selective. The more critical issue is when and where this occurred. Was it as Jesus was entering Jericho or as he was leaving Jericho? I would argue that it's when he's leaving Jericho. That's what Mark tells us. That's what Matthew tells us. And I would argue that Luke doesn't tell us otherwise. It all hinges on how you translate the Greek here. The Greek simply uses the word engidzo. And it can mean, engidzo can mean to draw near to approach, as he was nearing Jericho. That's possible. But as he was nearing Jericho, from what frame of reference? Well, he had been in Galilee a matter of weeks before, and now, and then more recently, he's been in various villages in the Transjordan, and then as he heads toward Jerusalem, he has to go through Jericho because that's where you ford the Jordan River, that's where you cross the Jordan River to make the approach up to Jerusalem. So to be nearing Jericho simply means to come into the vicinity, to come into the neighborhood of Jericho. And indeed, the word doesn't even have to mean to draw near. It can simply mean to be near. For example, the Septuagint uses that word in Leviticus to describe a person who is in a near relationship to another person, a sister, for example. A sister is a near relation to her brother. And it uses the word engidzo, a form of the verb engidzo, to describe her relationship to her brother. Well, she didn't draw near in her relationship to her brother. She just was near in her relationship to her brother. So I think the field of meaning of the word engidzo does not require any implication that he is approaching or drawing near to Jericho. It just simply means when he was in the vicinity of Jericho. Probably Luke uses that language because he doesn't exactly know the chronology. He knows it happened at Jericho at this point in Jesus' journey, but he doesn't know how it fits in relationship to the next story that we're going to read, which is Nicodemus, and he doesn't know how to fit it into the narrower chronology, so he just simply puts it here and says, when he was near Jericho. So again, it's not in conflict with Matthew and Mark. The thing that's most remarkable to me about this whole thing is, again, decades ago when I was studying this issue, a lot of the people who believed in biblical inerrancy, who were defending biblical inerrancy, came up with a theory that, well, there are actually two Jerichos. There's the old city Jericho and the new city Jericho, and I'm not challenging that. I think there probably is some truth to that. But there's the old city Jericho, and then there was the newer part of the city Jericho that were not exactly contiguous. And so that this event occurred when he was leaving the old Jericho and entering the new Jericho, and that the difference in the Luke account and the Matthew Mark account is which Jericho that they were talking about. Now, I can't dismiss that. The amazing thing is how bizarre reality is. The events of reality are very, very, very coincidental, curious, bizarre, and so those kinds of things do in fact happen. Years and years and years ago, I did an experiment in a class I was working where I wrote four different accounts of a vacation that Jody and I had taken. And all four of the accounts were completely accurate. There were no errors in them. I mean, it's me, right? I'm infallible. But all four accounts were true, were without error in them. But I would do things like talk about spending the night at Tahoe instead of at the particular lake just above Tahoe in the mountains that I called by name. Well, you can take both perspectives. I mean, you can describe where you are by a very familiar land site, or you can describe where you are more precisely, and no one's going to know where that is. It just depends on how you want to write your account. And I would make different decisions like that. Well, when you read all four of them side by side, it looked absolutely ludicrous to think that they could all be right. For example, as one person calculated and figured out, if these accounts are inaccurate, you would have had to have left Ashland, Oregon at 2 a.m. in the morning and driven all night and arrived in San Jose at I can't remember what time. And who would do that? Well, that is exactly what happened. I mean, that is how it went down. So, but it was just amazing to watch the debate in class, because what I did is I gave this to everybody, and then I seeded it with some people. I said, these are inerrant accounts. With others, I said, these are not inerrant accounts. And others, I said, I'm not telling you. You figure it out. And so I wanted some people to make the case for why it was inerrant, other people to make the case why this was not inerrant, and others to just have to be on their own. And the debate sounded just like the debate that between biblical inerrantists and inerrantists. You idiot, you're just making that stuff up. I mean, look at all the gymnastics you're having to go through to prove that that you can reconcile these accounts. I mean, this is just wishful thinking on your part. No, but it could be true. It could have happened that way, you know. And the back and forth was just exactly like you read in the debate over inerrancy. None of that's relevant here, but what was interesting to me is, in looking at it this time, there's this word with a very, very vague field of meaning in Gidzo. Why on earth did those people who were defending biblical inerrancy, did it not even occur to them that maybe our translation's wrong? Or not wrong, but maybe our translation is misleading us here. And I think the reason for that is because two things are at work in our interpretation of the Bible. One is, even people who know Greek don't interpret in Greek, they interpret in English. We translate into English, but we think and interpret in the English. We don't think and interpret in the Greek. And I think that gets us in a lot of trouble. And then the second thing is, there's this kind of conservatism that sets in, that says, if our English translation says he was approaching Jericho, then I'm going to have to go with that. I dare not challenge that. And my contention would be that in all kinds of different ways, both of those facts has been misleading, has got us into trouble, has trapped us, has got us stuck in ways of looking at the accounts that are, I think, false, just aren't right. It seems clear as can be here that Luke is not saying that he was entering Jericho, but simply locating it in the vicinity of Jericho. Why not go with that? Why do we not take it that way? Okay, none of that's very edifying, so let's go on. As the account reads, this blind beggar and his sidekick, but probably Bartimaeus is the one doing the assertive behavior, he's trying to figure out what's going on. There's this throng of people going on. Right? Remember, in these next two accounts, I don't know if we'll get to the second one, but in these two accounts that we're looking at, the throng, the crowd that we're talking about, is not a throng or crowd that is lining the streets, the roads, as if this were a parade that everybody was watching. It's the crowd of people that are traveling with Jesus. So this nice, quiet day in Jerusalem, blind beggar sitting by the side of the road, and all of a sudden there's this ton of people that start walking down the road beside him. And as the leading edge of this crowd comes through, this blind beggar saying, what's going on? Who's coming? Who are you guys? And they inform him, well, Jesus of the Nazarene is coming. And when he learns that Jesus the Nazarene is coming, so the picture here, and this will become important with Nicodemus, Zacchaeus, sorry, that's coming up. Jesus is in the middle of this crowd, surrounded by all of his followers. Half of them in front, half of them behind. He's just surrounded by his followers as they're traveling together down the road. So he asks, who's coming? It's Jesus the Nazarene. The minute he sees that it's Jesus the Nazarene coming, he starts crying out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. The people that are hearing this, that who are preceding Jesus down the road, they say, shut up. You know, be quiet. Now, why are they saying that? I don't think there's any special explanation for that. I think it's just normal human behavior. Whenever anyone is particularly socially gauche, you know, kind of out of line and inappropriate, you get embarrassed, don't you? You know, this is embarrassing behavior. You're being obnoxious. And because somebody is being obnoxious, they make me uncomfortable. I don't want to be uncomfortable, so I want them to quit. And I don't think it's anything more complicated than that. He's just making a scene, and they don't like the discomfort that it brings to them when he's making a scene. But Jesus responds differently. He stops, and he asks for them to lead the blind man into the middle of this throng to him. When he got there, he says, what do you want me to do for you? He says, I want to see. I want to see again. And Jesus said, okay, so see. And immediately he sees. Apparently, Jesus' reputation has gone before him, and that only stands to reason, because we know from earlier in the Gospel of Luke that his reputation went out far and wide from Galilee. And in fact, people would travel from all over the region to come to Galilee to find Jesus and that he might heal them. So that's not at all surprising that this blind beggar, Bartimaeus, when he learns who it is, recognizes an opportunity. Jesus has come to me. I want what he can give me. I want to see. Jesus said to him, see once again, your faith has made you well. We've run into that before in Luke. Your faith has made you well. Or I didn't double check. I'm almost certain it literally would be your faith has saved you. Soto. Because soto can mean save in the sense that we think of salvation, or it can simply mean more generically fix, heal, remedy, that kind of thing. And that's the sense of it here. You're seeing because of your faith, he's saying to him. Now, we've talked about this before, so I won't spend a lot of time here, but we misunderstand and we misconstrue what Jesus is saying if we think that what he's saying is, if you just have enough faith, then you become a person who is a channel and a receiver to the grace and mercy of God, and it's your faith that allows you to be healed. And the operative dynamic is not the power of God. The operative dynamic is my faith. All of faith healing and so much of charismatic culture, it's built on that assumption, that paradigm, that faith is somehow a spiritual sensitivity in me that makes it possible for God to work. That's not what Jesus is saying. And we know that's not what Jesus is saying, because there's all kinds of other miracles where Jesus just does miracles. And the poor victim of the miracle doesn't even know it's coming. They're just healed. They didn't have any faith. They didn't even know they were supposed to have any faith. He just heals them. So the operative dynamic is the power of God. God heals whom God will heal. God fixes what God wants to fix. And he is totally capable of doing anything that he wants to do. Jesus knows that. God knows that. The correlation between Bartimaeus' faith and his being healed is his confession. Son of David, have mercy on me. He is recognizing the authority that Jesus has. He's recognizing the role that he has. By calling him Son of David, he's acknowledging this isn't just somebody descended from David. This is the Son of David. The one that we've been waiting for, the one that's been promised, the one who's coming. This is the one who's going to be the king. And it's his confession that God is ratifying and affirming by doing the miracle. And you see that over and over and over again in Jesus' ministry. Somebody will confess, I believe that you are the Christ, and then they will be healed. What is the effect of that? Their confession is being honored by God. Not for their sake, but for the sake of everybody looking on. Is it true what they said, that Jesus is the Son of God? Yes, look what God has done to put his fingerprints all over that confession. That's what Jesus is saying here as well. Directly the man could see again, and he began to follow Jesus, glorifying God. Now when all the people understood what happened, they offered praise to God. Now this isn't a particularly, I mean, by this time in the Gospel of Luke, you go, no duh, Jesus does this kind of thing. He heals blind people and stuff. I mean, why are you telling me this account in this kind of detail? Because, I mean, there's other passages where Luke will say, and people were bringing their sick and affirmed to him, and he was healing them all until the end of the day or something like that. So this is not a big deal in relative to the rest of Jesus' ministry. Why is this here? I think the reason this is here is because this may not be unusual in Jesus' ministry, but this is unusual in Jericho. Now, I don't know this for sure. This is an argument from silence. But there's only 5 miracles that occur within 50 miles of Jerusalem, recorded in the gospel. There's this one. There's one coming up, which is a big deal, which got Jesus crucified when he raised Lazarus from the dead. That's coming up here shortly. So you have those two on the doorsteps of Jerusalem. And then you have 3 in Jerusalem. You have him cursing the fig tree in the valley of the Kidron going up to Jerusalem. And then within the city itself, he heals the lame man at the pool of Siloam and the blind man by slapping mud in his eyes and having him go wash in some pool. I got that wrong. They're washing the pool of Siloam. I can't remember who it was, the lame man who was sitting by the other pool. Bethesda, yeah. Notice the fig tree, the only people who saw it were the disciples. That's not a public miracle. Notice in the only 2 public miracles that he performed in Jerusalem, he was gone by the time the healing occurred. In the case of the man that he slapped mud in his eyes, and I've often wondered, why did you slap mud in his eyes? And I think this is the reason, because he needed time to split. He couldn't be connected with this miracle. That wouldn't have worked strategically. So he was going to heal the man, but he had to be gone so the crowd couldn't find him and react and however they were going to react when they found out that a miracle occurred. And in the case of the lame man, it says he escaped through the crowd. I mean, he snuck out away. He didn't stay there to receive any praise. So those 3 Jerusalem miracles are not, he keeps them from not being publicly, he keeps from being publicly acclaimed in the context of those miracles. The only 2 miracles, and they're not even in Jerusalem, they're in Jericho and Bethany, I think. These 2 miracles are on the outskirts of Jerusalem, but and they're the ones that get him killed. That he knows he's going to Jerusalem to go to his crucifixion. There's no reason not to perform miracles any longer. If this outrages the religious establishment, that's the point. Because he wants to bring on the events that the prophets have predicted. So I think this event is noteworthy, not because he's healing a blind person. That's no big deal for Jesus. But he's healing a blind person right on the doorstep of Jerusalem, on the last journey to Jerusalem, where he's going to his death because he's going to cross the religious establishment and get himself in big trouble. And he's beginning that with this miracle right here. Okay. Then we go on to the next event. When he had entered Jericho, he was intending to pass through it. This is 19:1. But when he entered Jericho, he was intending to pass through it. But lo and behold, there was a man called Zacchaeus by name. He was a head tax collector, and he was rich. Okay, he's entered Jericho on his journey. He was intending to pass through it. But lo and behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus. I think what Luke is trying to tell us is, it was not Jesus' intent to spend the night in Jericho. it was Jesus' intent to pass through Jericho and probably go on to his friends, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus in Bethany or Bethphage, whichever village they lived in. That was probably his intent. But his intent, his plans changed when this man Zacchaeus, when he encountered this man Zacchaeus, and then Luke is going to give us the account of this encounter with Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was a head tax collector, and he was rich. If, as a head tax collector, he must have been very rich. We've probably confronted this before, but let me just review. At this time in history, the Romans used a tax farming system. And tax farmers were people who would contract with Rome. They would often buy the rights to be the tax collector, pay the Caesar the money so that he could get the job. If you had the job as tax collector, basically Rome, Caesar would say to you, here's how much money we want to get out of this people for the fishing they do or for the pottery that they make or whatever it is that they're taxing. Here's how much money Rome expects to receive from that. I don't care how much you charge them. I don't care how much you tax them. But here's how much we're going to get. Well, obviously, that's a wide open invitation to fleece the people. You charge exorbitant taxes. Rome's going to back you up. Rome, with their swords, are going to back you up. And you can get out of them however much you can manage to get out of them. And you only owe Rome what you promised to give Rome. Well, tax collectors could often get very, very, very wealthy and were very, very hated because everybody knew what was going on. Everyone knew that this was just an official form of thievery, robbery, that they couldn't do anything about. So tax collectors were social pariahs. They were absolutely outcast in their society. They were traitors to their own people. They were thieves. They were robbers. They were greedy SOBs, and the only friends they could find would be the friends that they could buy with their money, and they were typically other outcasts in their society. Well, this is Zacchaeus, and he's not just a tax collector, he's a head tax collector. By being a head tax collector, it means he has several people under him who are actually doing the collecting the taxes, and he's raking in the profit from everything that everyone under him is managing to fleece out of the Jewish people. Well, Zacchaeus was trying to see who this Jesus was, verse 3, but he was unable to see because of the crowd, for he was short in stature. Can you remember the scene? This is a whole flock of people going down the road, a large flock of people. Jesus is smack dab in the middle of them. So all he sees is the outer skirts of this crowd. He's too short to be able to see over the people to see this Jesus himself. So his strategy is, running on ahead to get in front of the crowd, he went up into a sycamore tree in order that he might see him, for Jesus was about to pass by that way. So he climbs up this tree to get high enough to be able to peer down into the middle of the crowd so that he can see Jesus when he goes by. We don't have any indication that he wants anything more than just to see Jesus. Now, when Jesus got to his location, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. And he hurried and came down and was delighted to welcome him into his home. In our culture, I don't think we quite understand what's going on here. I mean, if someone came up to me and said, "Hi, Jack, I'm going to stay at your house for a week. You're going to give me hospitality for a week." I don't know that I would be delighted to welcome him into my home. I'm a nice guy, so I would do it and I would smile. But we would see that as an imposition. And Zacchaeus, and normally people in this society, maybe they would have seen it as an imposition. That I don't know. I mean, they're a much more hospitable culture than ours is, so I can't answer that. But the fact that he was delighted to welcome into his home, I think stems from the fact that he's a tax collector and a head tax collector. He's a social pariah. You're going to come and stay in my home? No self-respecting Jew would be caught dead talking to me, let alone lodging with me. This is an incredible act of love on Jesus' part. I mean, that Jesus saying, I'm going to come and you're going to show me hospitality tonight at your home, that's the ultimate in affirmation and acceptance of Zacchaeus by Jesus. Jesus is saying, you're no social pariah to me. You're no outcast to me. You're no worthless scum to me. I'd be delighted to have you show me hospitality. I'm not afraid of that. It's a courageous act. It's an outrageous act. It's a provocative act, as we will see, and it's an incredibly loving act towards Zacchaeus. Upon seeing this, they all started to grumble, saying, he has gone in to lodge with a sinful man. So, I mean, you see recorded here what the effect of this was. They don't much like what Jesus has done here. Zacchaeus stopped and said to the Lord, Lord, look, I will give half of my possessions to the poor, Lord, and if I have cheated anyone of anything, I will pay them back four times what I took. Then Jesus said with reference to him, today's salvation has come to this house, for he is indeed a son of Abraham. The Son of Man came to find and restore what has been lost. I'm going to run out of time. I think what I want to do is make some brief comments here, and then we will come back next week and revisit these last two paragraphs here, because I think they deserve a lot more time and attention than I can give them before I run out of time today. What I want to explore next week is when Zacchaeus stopped and said to the Lord, look, I will give half of my possessions to the poor, Lord, and if I have cheated anyone of anything, I will pay them back four times what I took. And then Jesus responds to that, today's salvation has come to this house. Back when I was in college, Marxism was a powerful, powerful cultural legacy. All of us back in college in those days felt like we had to deal with the assumptions and the issues presented to us by Marxist thought. This, on the surface, is the kind of passage that I would have gone to say, see? Yeah, that we evangelicals are way too materialistic, and Jesus is fundamentally against the materialism, and he would be outraged by the materialism in our culture. And what we really need to do if we're going to really be followers of Jesus is give all of our money away and sell all of our church buildings and feed the poor and take care of the disadvantaged and bring justice to the world and use our resources to do that instead of being so selfish and fat and happy and easy as Americans. Yeah. It's very compelling. I mean, it's a very compelling picture. It's a very seductive picture. It's a very attractive picture. And it looks like that's what's behind this right here. What I want to look at is, he says, today salvation has come to this house, for he is indeed a son of Abraham. What Jesus is seeing is not, for indeed he's an anti-materialist, for indeed he is someone who wants to undo all the economic injustice in the world. That's not the basis for his saying salvation has come. The basis is that he is indeed a son of Abraham. So we need to look at that. What does it mean that Zacchaeus has demonstrated that he's a son of Abraham here? And to do that, we need to go look at an account in Abraham's life, an account in Moses' life, compare them, and come to some conclusions about what it is that Jesus is seeing here in Zacchaeus that makes him say salvation has come to his house. The problem is if you give it a Marxist reading, the problem is half? How come not three quarters? Half your possessions to the poor? You're keeping the other half, Zacchaeus? You got a problem. You're only paying back four times what you took? Why not five times? I mean, once you decide to read this in economic terms, then the issue becomes, how did Jesus know it was enough? Why was this a big deal in terms of economic redistribution here? How would you decide that? What I'm going to argue is it's not about that. That's not what's going on, and that's not what Jesus is responding to, but that's a longer story, and so we'll do that next week. So let me open it up to your comments or questions.
Jack, it has to do with the blind guy referring to Jesus as the son of David.
Mm-hmm.
Is this like unique? I mean, you don't see many others calling Jesus the son of David, although, I mean, do people think of him as the son of David? Or mm-hmm. in general, I mean, is it common knowledge that he is the son of David?
That's my impression. I actually haven't gone to look with that question in view, but this didn't strike me as unusual. I think he's not infrequently referred to as the son of David. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but that didn't strike me as unusual.
Hey, Jack.
Hi.
I was just wondering, why did miracles stop?
Why'd they stop?
Yeah, do we have a biblical account of, like, why? Like, do they stop within the Bible time? Like, I'm trying to think of Acts, and it's like they seem to be happening in Acts all the way to the end, I imagine, or there's nothing abrupt about the ending of miracles, and I'm just... Why did that happen?
Well, yeah, no, there's no biblical account of when or why it happened. So you just have to try to triangulate from the data that we have. My account would be, my argument would be, I don't think they necessarily have altogether happened, stopped. They haven't altogether stopped. God can do a miracle whenever he wants to do a miracle. And you have to make a distinction between a sign and a miracle. I mean, oftentimes miracles that God does are just to be merciful, are just to be compassionate. They're not about credentials and signifying the truth of the gospel. God just sometimes is really good to us and blesses us by giving us health when it would look like nature would not give us health, give us safety when it looks like safety was impossible. I mean, those kinds of things, most of us probably have stories of one kind or another that along those lines of where we saw the hand of God at work in our life. But those are not signs. I'm not going to be able to take those to Bertrand Russell and say, see, because they oftentimes those miracles are subject to my being privy to what I'm privy to, my close-in experience and knowledge. I know that this must have been God, but it would be very easy for someone else to say, yeah, but coincidences happen. And they do. I mean, that from the standpoint of an objective observation of it, yeah, it was an unusual event, but hey, that doesn't, unusual things happen. That's true. What makes a sign is that it's somehow very, very intimately attached to a word, a touch, something where it is publicly obvious that this is God doing it, or Jesus, his authoritative Messiah doing it, or something. And it makes sense to me why signs stopped. Signs stopped because what it is that they were to credential has already been credentialed. That the New Testament that we have, which is the apostolic testimony to what Jesus came into the world to proclaim and teach, I have access now in the New Testament to what it is that they proclaimed. And it is not insignificant to me that these people who wrote this raised people from the dead, healed people in the name of Jesus. You know, that Jesus didn't heal in the name of Jesus, but the apostles did. You know, they're healing in the name of Jesus because they're claiming that it's in order to credential the role and function and authority of Jesus, in order that you might know that he is who he says he is, be healed. And it's their way of affirming and credentialing that message through a remarkable event. Well, it's significant that the apostles did that because they're the ones claiming to be spokesmen for Jesus in the world. Well, it becomes all the more plausible that they actually were a spokesman for Jesus if the same credentialing of God that credentialed Jesus as the Messiah could continue to credential them as apostles. But once their message is out there and recorded, it doesn't need to go on. I mean, Jesus himself came to an end of his miracle sign-giving at times. Luke recorded earlier in Luke that in Nazareth, the Spirit of God was not present to perform miracles because, and I can't remember, but something about the heart of the people in Nazareth. Well, basically, when God realizes that people's hearts are so hard that no sign in the world is going to make any difference, then he stops giving them signs. So it's not necessarily the case that if a dozen signs is good, three dozen would be better. It doesn't work that way. There comes a point where you're just brutalizing people's heart with evidence when they don't want to believe, and they have demonstrated that they don't want to believe, and any further sign is only going to harden them further. It's not going to bring them closer to the kingdom of God. So once this is credentialed, what more do we need? And I think it's out of that kind of logic that God just stopped giving signs in the world.
I have the mic over here. Hi, Jack.
Okay.
Thank you for working through the potential alleged conflict between the various passages and issues related to inerrancy and that kind of thing. And I was wondering if you could take a couple minutes maybe to say whether or not it matters whether the Bible is inerrant, and if so, why, and if not, why. Would you mind doing that?
Mm-hmm. It'd be better if I'd prepared some comments. But, what I decided decades ago is that oftentimes the argument against inerrancy is, well, who cares whether they're one or two blind beggars? I mean, the fact that he healed them, isn't that a big enough deal? Who cares how many there were? And someone like me who believes in inerrancy doesn't care any more than they do whether there were one or two. That's not the issue for me. I don't want precise facts, and I'm really have this obsession with precise facts, and therefore that's why I want the Bible to be inerrant, so that I can know that all the facts are precise. Inerrancy is important to me because I need to know whether the message of the Bible itself, the important message of the Bible, the relevant message of the Bible, the gospel itself, is that true? Does that have integrity? And because I want that to have integrity, what do I do if I have a text that's supposedly proclaiming to me the straight story on what Jesus the Messiah came into the world to teach us in terms of the gospel and the truth about life? It's claiming to give me the straight story on that, but it can't even count. What do I do with that? I mean, the same process of inspiration that is supposedly giving me this reliably is giving me unreliable historical facts. When there would come a point where the disconnect between those two would become so overwhelming that this becomes implausible. Now, that doesn't necessarily argue for absolute total inerrancy, although I believe in absolute total inerrancy, but the point I'm making is just there would come a critical point where the degree of unreliability of the Bible on unimportant issues would become so problematic that it would erode my trust in the important stuff in the Bible. So that's my perspective. I'm not like some people. I don't think you're going to go to hell if you don't believe in biblical inerrancy. I think that's too extreme. But as someone who's devoted my life and spent my life trying to understand the Bible, it makes all the difference in the world how I approach it, if I approach it as inerrant. I mean, there's all kinds of conclusions that I've reached because I believe in biblical inerrancy. I never would have got there if I hadn't wrestled with, but this seems to be in conflict. I mean, if you go, well, duh, it was written by men, you stop. You stop thinking. You stop looking. You stop trying to understand, and you miss out on what I think is actually the truth that's there, because you wouldn't do the work to try to ask the question, but is there some way of putting these two things together? And if there is a way of putting them together, it's the coherent picture that was intended to be communicated to us in the Bible. And that's what we're after. That's what we want. So people who are students of the Bible who dismiss biblical inerrancy, I would argue, are crippling themselves. They're pulling out one of their eyes and chopping off one of their ears. They're really making it difficult on themselves to actually get to the message for that reason.
Thank you.
You commented that this issue of whether the faith of Zacchaeus, no, the blind man, was operative or the work of God, and that you argued it was the work of God. Excuse me, I'm about to cough. But you then said the blind man made a confession, and that was, if you will, operative, or that was something that Jesus recognized. And you imply there's a connection there between his confession and God's working.
Right, yeah.
Is that different than faith? You know, I want to believe that yes, it's about God's work. It makes it easier for me because my faith isn't always that consistent. But this seems like, again, there was something that person did that is related to God's response and God's working.
I think I was very confusing there. Let me try again. What I was trying to say is, remember the scene in Star Wars where Yoda is, have you ever seen Star Wars? No. Oh. Okay.
Sorry, I have to admit.
I don't know where to go from here. Well, Taoism teaches that there's the Tao, and my individuality is just a kind of superficial epiphenomenon. My individuality is not what's important. What's important is the Tao. And so Taoism instructs you to live your life by getting what they call your surface self out of the way and allowing the Tao to work and flow through you. So the Tao does its work and accomplishes its purpose, and you erase yourself and become of no account. There are many versions of Christianity teach exactly the same thing. They're kind of a Christian Taoism, and I taught it for years. That's what I was trained in, not raised in, but that's what I was trained and educated in. That we need to get myself out of the way, become utterly and completely dependent upon the power of God at work through me, and allow God to work through me. Now, they call that faith in that picture. Faith is me not working, not doing anything, not exerting myself, me setting myself aside that the Spirit of God might work and empower me and be through me.
Fundamentally passive or
exactly.
Even self...
Erasing. Exactly. There's a close counterpart to that in the faith healing community, and that is there's a move that I can make to make me receptive to the effects of the power of God, and that if I don't have that receptivity, I'm going to block the power of God. God can't heal you if you don't have faith, is the way it would be construed. And so what is that faith? Well, whatever it is, it's some kind of openness, receptivity, some kind of turning myself over to God to let him work and putting me out of the way. People often look at a passage like this that says your faith has made you well and say, see, that's what Jesus is teaching. That he thinks that the reason Zacchaeus got healed, Bartimaeus. The reason Bartimaeus got healed is because of his faith. And where'd the faith come from? Well, he came up with it. He's just one of those people who had enough faith. That's what I'm confronting. What I'm arguing instead is there a connection between him being healed and his faith? Absolutely, there's a connection. But the connection is God wants to credential his confession, his belief, his faith. I mean, I'm taking faith differently. His faith is Jesus really is the Son of God. That's his faith. It's his belief. It's his confession. It's his affirmation that Jesus is who Jesus has come into the world to say that he is. He really is that. Well, Bartimaeus believes that. Because he has given evidence that he believes that, then God, who's the dynamic power that heals people when healing happens, God comes and heals him in front of all these people publicly in order that the message can be sent. This belief that Bartimaeus has, that Jesus really is that Son of David that he believes he is, God is honoring his profession of faith. His claim is being ratified by God himself supernaturally. So there is a connection between the faith and the miracle. But faith is confession, not a certain state of being that makes me receptive to the power of God. That's a very different kind of concept of faith. So I have a different concept of faith, and then the relationship between them is not cause and effect. So it's not that the faith causes the healing to be able to occur, it's that God willed it to occur because of the faith, purposed for it to occur because of the faith.
Is there a mistake in the translation where it says your faith has healed you?
I don't think so.
Because
no.
That's pretty, that is a cause and effect statement.
Well, it doesn't have to be, okay. but that's a very natural way to take it. That's true.
Yeah.
But I don't think it has to be. It's because what Jesus...
Or it says, because you have faith, it implies, or I think it said, you know, because you have faith, you are healed, is what that...
Okay, it could mean that, or is it saying, now I want you to rightly interpret what happened here. Why has God chosen to heal you? Because of your faith. Now, why would God choose to heal him because of his faith? Because God likes people to have that faith. God wants people, all these people around, to know that there is a blessing and a reward in store for people who have that confession, who make that confession. That's how I think he means it.
I think you might... mean to say, and correct me because I could be wrong, is that if his faith made him well, then why did he need Jesus? Why didn't he need God?
Right.
If literally,
right,
in those simple words, your faith has healed you, I mean, Jesus didn't even need to be in the crowd. In fact, the guy doesn't even need to have God hanging over Jerusalem.
He didn't need to wait for a crowd with Jesus in the middle to go by.
Right. In fact, he's just suddenly become aware that he has this magic power,
right,
called faith that heals himself.
Right.
And if we take those simple words completely, simply, literally, then that's what it means. So all Jesus needed to do was go around and find people who have faith and make them aware of the fact that they have the power to heal themselves.
Right.
And I'm sure there are people out there doing that.
And that's the foundation of Christian Science.
Yeah, and that's the misunderstanding of the use of language.
Right. Yeah. One more, right? Whether you're right or not, I don't know, but...
this just reminded me of Hebrews 11 when it talks about faith, and it doesn't seem like the faith of Bartimaeus is any different than the faith of the Old Testament the people who had faith, because in verse 6 it says, without faith it's impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he's a rewarder of them who seek him.
Exactly.
It seems like it's the same faith that God has always required.
Exactly. And that's what God is responding to. Exactly. Okay, I've kept you over. I'll better let you go.